Hello, and welcome once again to Radio Prague International. I'm David Vaughan. Episode in our series, A Stitch in Time, where young people tell stories from their family history, we have a taste of sugarcane from Guangdong province in China. We meet a Jewish boy in Baltimore who remembers his own circumcision, and a teenager from Brno takes us to a twilight zone of the unexplained.
I think it's very important to embrace mysteries, and that as humans we always want to figure out and come up with an explanation for something, but actually there's quite a beauty in the unknown.
It's a mix of Hanukkah and Christmas. We don't always have Santa Claus, sometimes it's Yetmaros, which is Father Christmas for us.
I was adopted at a very young age, so I don't have a record of my biological parents. I thought of the story as an opportunity to connect to that side of my family's past.
As you might guess from these short extracts, we have three very different stories, reflecting the complexities and even some of the mysteries of the world we live in. Natalie Rowe from Brno brings us what may or may not be a ghost story, recounting an experience her father had as a soldier. Anne-Lee Frisk imagines her biological parents having to leave their life in rural China to go to the city. And Lucienne Erent tells the story of her father leaving the Soviet Union as a 13-year-old in 1977 for a new life in the United States.
I'm Lucy, or Lucienne Erent. I'm 13 years old and I live in Prague, or Prague 7, near Letna Park and Stromovka. The thing about roots, I have come to realize, is that they fulfill the same purpose for people as they do for plants. Roots keep you connected to the world and standing upright, but they do so invisibly, stretching deep into the past. I decided to write about my grandparents and my father around the time when they managed to escape Russia during the USSR and managed to end their early life in America.
I often connect my 13 stable years of life in Prague to my father's journey, which twisted and twined all around the globe, ending up in Prague, but with a long American odyssey through Los Angeles, Chicago, and Baltimore, until... If we move backward along all the stories I've heard, we finally get to the very beginning. Leningrad, USSR's City of White Knights, and grand bridges opening for passing ships, with the small ghosts of former communist pioneers, my dad among them, wearing red ties and marching around in perfect lines. It was right at 13, my age now, that my dad's life was transformed. Up until then, he lived one year to the next in a communist-era communal apartment, which held five Leningrad families, each family in one room, all sharing the kitchen and the bathroom.
How did you go about gathering material for the story?
My dad told me quite a few stories of the transition in his life around the same age as me at the time. And my grandparents live around the street from where I live, so I managed to visit them often and hear stories from them.
My dad was admitted to an elite school because they thought he was a genius since he could recite Pushkin's poetry by heart. That didn't last long. He had so much difficulty reading books and doing his homework that these days he would probably be diagnosed with dyslexia. My grandfather was so anxious about it that he would read all my dad's homework out loud to him. Of all the books which my grandpa recited,
Dad's favorite was the Russian version of Kipling's famous The Jungle Book. He was fascinated by the elegant black panther Bagheera, portrayed as feminine in the Russian translation. Right as they finished the last Jungle Book story, Dad's whole school class was marched through the streets of Leningrad to demand freedom for the beautiful civil rights activist Angela Davis, a member of the American Black Panther Party. Dad was a bit confused about the connection between Bagheera, the majestic black panther who stalked through his dreams of being Mowgli, and the lovely heroic woman on the posters who was locked up in an American jail. He longed to go to the USA to free Angela Davis, the human Bagheera, when suddenly, just like the magical journeys that he had only known from his books, his mother told him that his family was going on exactly this adventure. Like any good book adventure, he was sworn to secrecy about their plans to get to America. His parents were worried that if one thing went wrong and they had to stay in Russia, everyone would treat them badly if they knew they had tried to leave. My grandpa had already lost his job as an engineer and was made to work in a boiler room for months just for applying to get out of the USSR. At that time, my grandparents were among the first people to receive Jewish refugee status to go to America. My grandma once told me that a major reason she took the risk, which might destroy their lives, was because Dad was such a poor schoolboy that she knew he would end up in the Soviet army, and she desperately did not want that. She was an epidemiologist who had to report on the health conditions of the city schools. Even though her salary was nothing, she many times refused bribes to look the other way from schools that didn't follow the regulations that would keep kids safe. But none of her strength ever erased the cruel words of the border guard who searched their suitcases before finally letting them go. Good for you. You are never going to see your family alive again. In too many cases, he was right. In Baltimore, the first home that wasn't Russia, everything that surrounded my family was different and strange. Everything in the apartment had been donated, including the apartment. Dad had his own room after a lifetime spent in the same room with his parents. But the furniture in it was a white and gold princess bedroom set meant for a girl, including a bed with a fancy decorated bedpost, a lavish dresser, and a curvy wardrobe. My teen dad just ignored the feminine furniture, happy enough to have his own space. Later, he made the room more his own, with a poster of Bagheera on the wall, and with American Revolution bedsheets and curtains. But my grandma would walk into his room every day to sit on the bed and look around in amazement. This was the very furniture that she had dreamed about having as a little girl. This was a little piece of the childhood she had longed for and could now finally enjoy. Meantime, my dad and my grandpa were having their own adventures. The first morning, it was time to explore. To be respectful to their new country, they put on their very best clothes, including fancy ties. In all this formal dress, they strolled farther and farther into Baltimore's downtown. Soon, they started to notice that everyone on the street around them was an African American. Dad had only seen a few black people in his life, maybe two or three African students who came to university in Russia. Now, he wondered if these people belonged to the heroic Black Panther Party and even knew Angela Davis personally. My grandpa and dad went into stores to look at all the unknown things and try to understand what everything was. Of course, they spoke to each other in Russian since they had so little English, and people looked very surprised when they heard them. That evening, when they told the representatives of the refugee organization about their day, their hosts were upset, informing them that they had wandered into Baltimore's ghetto, a tough, dangerous neighborhood. It never occurred to them that this was a scary or poor area. Everyone had been very nice. Was it true, after all, what they had been taught in the USSR about American race problems? Or was it Soviet propaganda? More than anything, my grandparents wanted my dad to try to fit in.
My grandma was determined that my dad would not seem like a misfit around American kids. Using what they knew about American style, which came from underground disco records they had managed to hear at family and friends' houses and smuggled foreign magazines in Russia, they bought Dad a blazing pair of striped disco bell-bottom pants for his first school day and a pair of tall platform shoes to round out his look. When Dad started school the next week, he may not have fit in as much as his parents had hoped, since the other kids were much more calmly dressed in faded jeans and worn sneakers. But, judging from the surprised and intrigued looks they shot his way, they took him for a miniature rock star. At least, this is what my dad has always believed. He can't be sure since for the first year he struggled to understand a word that anyone in school said to him. Still, another complicated issue that my grandparents had to decide about because they wanted so much for my teen dad to fit in with his new country was the question of circumcision. Most Jewish boys around the world are circumcised at 7 days old when they are infants. But in Russia, religion was suppressed and this ritual was mostly given up. Of course, most American boys are also circumcised when they are infants. My grandparents felt worried that a boy who looked quite different physically from other American boys in school locker rooms would always be teased. The painful result is that my dad might be one of the only men on this planet who can remember his own circumcision perfectly. I will end by sharing what my grandmother told me when I asked her when was the first time after leaving Soviet Russia that she felt truly free. Her reply was this. 1 year after they made it to Baltimore, my grandfather applied for a job as an engineer in Chicago, and he got the job. In the USSR, there was no such thing as just deciding to get a new job and relocating because you wanted to. For the first time in their lives, my grandparents not only moved somewhere far away just because they felt like it, but this time they didn't need any help from a refugee organization or any permissions from the authorities. They packed and went. They were free people who lived in a country where they had the power to start a new life again whenever and wherever they wanted.
You talk about your father and your grandparents going from the Soviet Union to the United States. How did the family end up in the Czech Republic? And is that where you've spent your whole life?
Yeah, I was born here. And it's kind of like they start traveling more and more. They're free. They could finally move from place to place. And my grandparents, they wanted to finally kind of settle somewhere where they could kind of be in Europe, closer to Russia, their old home, but still kind of not find somewhere safe, somewhere relaxing, where they could retire, so they moved to Prague because it's beautiful here. And my parents visited, and they've traveled here many times, but then they eventually decided to stay here and start a new life.
Do you feel at home in Prague, or do you feel also a more complicated identity?
It is a bit complicated. I've always felt Prague as my home. I know the place like the back of my hand. I know my town very well. But I've always had huge connections with places where my family stay in America.
Have you spent time in Russia as well?
No, I've never been there. I believe when I was 8 years old, my parents went to St. Petersburg on a trip, but they left me with my grandparents here.
And do you feel that this legacy in your family has influenced the way that you see the world?
Definitely. I think that if things were different, I wouldn't kind of see certain kind of ways of the world as I do today.
And do you also speak Russian at all or not?
Немножко.
And so you can speak with your grandparents, you can
speak
Russian together.
Yeah, I do
together.
Speak Russian with them.
And you have some Russian traditions at home, mm-hmm. some Czech traditions,
yeah,
some
exactly.
American traditions, some Jewish traditions. Do you mix them all together?
We do mix them all together. For example, December, it's a mix of Hanukkah and Christmas, but we don't always have Santa Claus. Sometimes it's Dед Мороз, which is Father Christmas for us.
So really, is that
yeah,
really
fun.
A bit of everything?
It is.
Our second story, set 4 years after Lucy's father left Leningrad, also talks of being uprooted and having to find a new home.
My name is Anli, and I was adopted from southern China, and my parents are both from Europe. I was adopted at a very young age, so I don't have a record of my biological parents. I thought of the story as an opportunity to connect to that side of my family's past, and that would be interesting to draw upon historical research to inspire it. And the economic reformation of the 1980s in China particularly stood out to me. So my piece is really just a speculation of their experiences.
Andy's story is short, so let's hear it in its entirety.
The story is set in the year 1981, Guangdong province of China. When a situation was not ideal, my father and mother had the persistent idea that we were resilient like the sugarcane crop we grew. I don't know if it really holds true or if it's something parents tell to console. I eyed the setting sun over the vast green of our fields, the sun slowly filtering out of the horizon. If I really think about it, the sun and the cycle of harvest and planting set the pace of life. A sweet humidity filled the air, and there was no longer the beating sun of the day. Before I enjoyed it too much, I crossed the courtyard and into our dwelling. I was invited by the aromas of supper that began to permeate the air and the promise of a full stomach. Arriving before I was called garnered an almost imperceptible appreciation, but I sensed the sad tension in Ma. Before I took to figuring out why, Pa walked in. Supper carried with it a similar air of solemnity to what I was used to, though this was more so today. Father began to talk. He laid out our future in an even tone. We would not farm anymore. We would move out to a growing city. The government informed him of this. We could not stay. We would have nowhere here anymore. There is no talk of the sugarcane resilience. Somehow, I did not know what to feel. Father explained that we were helping our country become modern. I was open to accepting this. My brother, Bing Wen, too young to understand, was oblivious. He won't remember the sugarcane. It was accepted fate. We did not and could not fight it or stick it out. Father became a factory worker at an already built one, and our fields, our home, were to be the grounds of a new one. And I went to a new regional school, which Bing Wen will attend once he is of age. I will become an engineer. Mother will have less work now, but I have heard the prospect of her finding a job to fill the newfound time. It's quite strange, but sugarcane is of the past. You look back on it as one would a historical spectacle. You could say, in our case, a sweet history. We moved into a high-rise apartment on the 7th floor, life now controlled by the repetitive rhythm of money.
I feel quite disconnected from, like, my biological family. So I guess maybe I could kind of relate by having to dive into their experiences. Quite sad because they have to change their lifestyle. So I more so felt kind of sad and empathizing with their situation.
My name is Natalie Rowe, and I have a British father and a Czech mother. Can't say where I'm from because we've moved around so much that I can't define that yet, but I have found many comfortable places where we've lived.
Natalie's story recounts an episode in her father's life.
Well, my dad, he was in the British military, and he's always telling me stories that he encountered while he was there. So this one in particular he told me once, I found really interesting, and it was my first idea when I was given the task to write about my ancestors. This was the first idea that came to me.
So here is Natalie's rather mysterious story.
The Man on the Hill. It was a dark night, and the grass was damp from the never-ending showers of rain. Wind blew wildly, and the trees were shaking from the cold, causing leaves to fall and fill the air like paper aeroplanes. Beneath it all marched a group of soldiers, moving stealthily through the wet fields. They were hungry and tired, but their mission was to meet Group Alpha on the top of Elder Hill by midnight. The captain walked in front of the other soldiers. He was tall and confident, strict but fair. It was their first night doing an operation together, and none of them were very well acquainted. Nevertheless, they were approaching the meet point fairly quickly, and it looked like they were going to arrive just on time, when one of the soldiers came to a halt. "What's that?" There, on a faraway hill, stood what looked like a man in a long black coat and cap. "Oi, you there! Put up your hands, or we'll shoot!" the captain shouted. But the man didn't move. "I said, put up your hands!" The man-like shadow, once again, did not move a muscle. "Captain, what do we do? He isn't responding." "Why don't you look through your scope? Try to see who it is," the captain said calmly, pointing to the soldier's rifle. The soldier did as commanded and bent down, placing one knee on the wet ground, then looking to see the man through his rifle. "What on earth?" The soldier looked up from the scope in disarray and then back at the scope. "What's wrong?" asked one of the soldiers impatiently. "I can't see him." "What do you mean you can't see him?" the captain scoffed. "I can't see him through the scope. That's impossible. He's right there." "Well, try it yourself," insisted the kneeling soldier. He handed the rifle to the captain and put his tired blue pale eye towards the scope. "Well, Bob's your uncle, you're right. I look up at the man, he's there, but when I look through the scope, he ain't there anymore." All four men took turns looking through their guns, but they couldn't understand why none of them were able to see the man. "Is this some kind of joke?" asked one of the soldiers. "Well, what do we do? Midnight is in 20 minutes. We don't have time to sit around here." They were all becoming restless. "Well, we can't shoot. He isn't an immediate threat. We must approach him," the captain said, looking at the group. "There are not many of us, but if we don't investigate, we might let a potential terrorist loose in this area. So stick close." They started walking towards the man. He was very still. He didn't move at all, and his ghost-like figure was making the soldier's stomach turn the closer they got. The captain walked, squinting, trying to make out his face, but all he could see was a dark silhouette under that cap. They were about 20 meters away from him. "Who are you?" the captain shouted one last time. No response. "All right, men, move in." "Captain, look!" "What?" "He's gone!" The captain looked back. The figure was nowhere to be seen. They started running to the hill, but by the time they reached the top, there was nothing left. "Where could he have gone? What was that? That's impossible to get off the hill this quick. We would have seen him. Captain, what do we do?" "We go back. There is nothing we can do now. I don't know what that was, but we have to focus on what we came here to do." And with that, the soldiers continued on their journey. But none of them were able to stop thinking about what they just saw. They got to Elder Hill, but there was no sign of the other group. So they waited around and watched, alert. One of the soldiers looked up at the sky. The wind had now stopped blowing, and the once gloomy clouds above them had cleared and revealed the whole family of twinkling stars. "Do you think it was an extraterrestrial?" asked one of the soldiers provocatively. "What makes you say that?" frowned the other soldier. "It's a clear night, and there's no way that thing was human." They suddenly heard the sound of approaching footsteps, and soon they saw the heads of four other soldiers come over the side of the hill. It was Team Alpha. They were covered in mud, and pieces of grass and moss were plastered to their body like wallpaper. "You are 10 minutes late. Where were you?" the captain asked furiously. The other group of filthy soldiers looked at him with blank stares. We don't know. We saw something." "What did you see?" "It was a man, a strange man. He was standing on a hill, and he didn't move. We tried to look at him through our scopes, but..." "You couldn't see him?" the captain interrupted. "Well, yes. You guys saw it too?" No one knew what happened that day around Elder Hill, and most probably nobody will. But those soldiers made sure to tell their story so that people knew that this life is still full of mysteries.
Would you define it as a ghost story?
I don't think I want to define it as a ghost story, but I certainly want to define it as maybe a mystery, because I know that it can seem that it's probably a ghost story if they couldn't see it through their scopes, but it's definitely a mystery, and I guess it can be interpreted in any way.
And how does your father interpret it?
When he first told me about the story, he said it was a ghost story, so I guess it can be interpreted as a ghost story, but I think mostly it's just a mystery.
It seems that part of the message of the story is that we should acknowledge the presence of mystery in our lives. Is that right?
I think it's very important to embrace mysteries, and that as humans we always want to figure out and come up with an explanation for something. But actually there's quite a beauty in the unknown, and it certainly makes a great story.
And that was Natalie Rowe. Many thanks not just to Natalie, but also to Anne-Lee Frisk and to Lucien Arendt. And given that this is the final episode, I'd also like to thank all the other young people whose stories we've heard over the last few weeks. And a special thank you as well to Leah Gaffin and Teresa Dubsky from Class Acts, and to Bára Dočkalová, who composed the theme tune, and Vít Beneš on the piano. You can find all the stories in text and as read by their authors on radio.cz. We'd also love to hear your comments, so please do get in touch at english@radio.cz. But for the time being, from me, David Vaughan, and all of us here, goodbye.